This is an ABC podcast.
Hello there. Welcome to the program. Australia's Catholic Church has signed up to almost every recommendation of the Royal Commission into Child Sexual Abuse. But does its decision to hold out on two issues suggest the Church is still in denial? We'll try to answer that question for you today on the Religion and Ethics Report. I'm Andrew West. And our focus on China wraps up with a look at the country's religious minorities. On Friday, the Catholic Church released its long-awaited response to the Royal Commission. It opposes just two recommendations. One is that the Church abandon the secrecy of the confession so that an offender who admits to sexual abuse can be reported to police. The other is that the Church end its practice of compulsory celibacy for priests, nuns, and brothers. Dr. David Leary leads the Franciscan Order of Friars here in Australia. Last week, he co-led a conference to urge major change to Catholic practice and doctrine, including confession.
I think it's fraught. I think there are situations where the seal of confession can be easily dispensed with. And I know at least two canon lawyers who spoke at our conference who would argue very strongly that in certain circumstances, the seal of confession is simply not relevant. There is also the argument, I think, that reconciliation or absolution should not be easily won, that people should actually be encouraged, even forced, to do something proactive about their behaviour and about their sinfulness before absolution is given. Now, all of those issues are still up for grabs as far as I can see. I think those matters will go to Rome. I don't think this is the end of the story. I think there will be a lot of discussion, ongoing discussion, because there is momentum around this particular issue. But this is the sort of issue that fighting the clergy or fighting the hierarchy in public about this will always get one single response, and that is no.
Okay, what about the other question that has been raised, and that is the contribution of compulsory celibacy to a culture that has allowed the sexual abuse of children? I mean, you yourself are a celibate man. Has it been your experience in religious life that this is a very frustrating practice that you think has dangerous potential?
There are two answers to that question. The first, is it a frustrating experience? Absolutely. But I suspect that fidelity in marriage can at times be a frustrating experience, or fidelity in partnership can be a frustrating experience. I think all relationship styles have their difficulties. That would be my first comment. I think our greatest problem is that celibacy is a rare event. It should be a rare event. I think we ordained way too many people, way too young, who were incapable of making a lifelong commitment to celibacy. I joined religious life when I was 50. I had a string of relationships, if I can be that brash, prior to joining a religious order. I had a very strong sense of where my sexuality and where my capacity for commitment to celibacy was up to at that point. I don't think celibacy is a game for young people. And I think that's where we made our mistakes in the past, and I think to some extent we still make that mistake. We vow people to a permanent style of living that they're not capable of sustaining because they're not, in many instances with regard to the Royal Commission, they're not psychosexually mature enough to do that.
Yeah. But just thinking about your own experience, David, you entered religious life as a very mature man. You have a PhD. Is it the case that if you take men who are in their late 20s, early 30s, who've had some experience, some exposure to life, gone through, let us say, the rites of passage of all young men, they're making a much more conscious decision about the life they're going to, A, leave behind and the life they're going to adopt. And this is going to make them, let us say, a lot more stable, aware people.
I agree. I think the minimum age should be somewhere in the 30s. But again, that depends on an individual person's level of psychological maturity, their capacity to make relationships. I think one of the things that we're acutely aware of now is that the sort of preparation that you engage a person with in their endeavour to become a religious has to be a lot more professionally based, has to be a lot more multidisciplinary. So psychology has a lot more to say about whether a person is ready to enter religious life and also whether they have a capacity. It's not just about desire, and I think that's what we focused on in the past. If a person has a desire to be a priest, well, that's great, but that's only part of the story. The other thing is, have they got a capacity to do that? And that's a critical issue.
Let's look at a couple of issues that you dealt with in your very thorough conference. Perhaps the overwhelming one was your call for a reformation of Australia's churches. Mm. It's a very good headline, but what would it mean in practice?
It was interesting. That was a line used by Professor Peter Sherlock, who's the Vice Chancellor of the University of Divinity, who comes out of a Protestant tradition as an Anglican. And so the word reformation was easily fell from his lips. It probably isn't a term that would easily fall from the lips of a Catholic. Nonetheless, reforming in its essence is what we have to be about. And that has to be cultural, but it needs to be strategic and it needs to be structural. So one of the great problems in the Catholic Church is that we really don't grasp that notion that we have to be much more transparent, much more accountable, and much more inclusive.
They can be done, though, by reforming the practices and the canons, i.e. the laws of the church. But you say that the church needs to reform its theology.
It does.
Now, that's going to the very heart of something. That's a big call. What theology do they have to change?
The first one would be the theology of the human person. The theology around sexuality, a theology that doesn't focus on sexual practices, but rather focuses on the quality of the relationships that occur between man and woman, man and man, whoever. A theology, an ecclesiology, a theology that takes into account the place, the true place of children. We don't have a theology which adequately masters the protection of children, and that's an area where we require a great deal of effort. A theology that is much more inclusive in its focus on the role of women in the church. You can change the structures, but if you don't change the thinking, then the culture won't change over a period of time.
Okay, so what is, David, and you've obviously been thinking about this deeply, what is the thinking that you're trying to overturn?
Centuries-old thinking about a hierarchical structure which really doesn't take into account notions of inclusivity, that is very heavily dominated by older, by and large, white males.
Despite the fact that the church is at its strongest in the non-European parts of the world.
Exactly.
That's very interesting.
Say, for example, the language in the Catholic Church in America, if it hasn't already reached the point of being dominantly Spanish, it will very soon. So I think there are huge gains to be made by looking at some of these key issues from both a strategic, a structural point of view, but also from a theological point of view.
And this means in practice what? A woman as the chancellor, which is not the same as a bishop, but the chief administrative person in a diocese, for example?
Sure, I think that's one example, but that tends to be a managerial role, and there is a difference between management and governance. Mm. So a manager tends to, within the church, implement the policies and the practices as determined by church governance. But where are the women in church governance? Where are they sitting at the table thinking about new ways of presenting the church to the world? Not radically shifting the story of the gospel, not radically shifting the direction of the church, except with regard to the types of participation that people have within the church.
David, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Dr. David Leary is a leader of the Franciscans in Australia, and he recently co-hosted a major conference urging massive church reform in the wake of the sex abuse scandal. And this is the Religion and Ethics Report. If you're perennially worried about your children or grandchildren hunched over their smartphones, tweeting, Facebooking, Instagramming, prepare yourself then for the next frontier in technology. Transhumanism blends humanity and technology, often literally, through changes to the body. Molecular biologist Dennis Alexander was until recently head of the Faraday Institute for Science and Religion at Cambridge University. He's coming to Australia next week for the 2018 New College Lectures. You'll hear a full discussion on next week's show, but here's a preview.
It's really the transhumanists who are pushing hardest on the technical transformation of humans. And of course, they envisage a future in which we won't be living in this failing biology, but they envisage down the line sometime, in fact, one has predicted the year 2045, when there will be this singularity where we will be transferred out of these failing human bodies into digital machines that will then be more intelligent than us and be able to continue their existence in what's sometimes called the great singularity. So they are very visionary, the transhumanists. I don't think there are so many transhumanists within the scientific community. It's hard to know, obviously. I haven't seen any sociological data on that. But there is a fringe, very vocal group who either within the scientific community or they're writers, thinkers, filmmakers, and so on, who dream dreams about this very technologically based type of human future.
And what is the biggest ethical challenge, certainly to people of faith, but to humanity generally, to come out of this transhumanist dream or possibly nightmare?
Of course, I think it depends what worldview one has on this. And I, as a Christian, see certain values which are really important in developing these sorts of ideas. If they're developed in terms of healing, then that's fine. After all, Jesus was the great healer and a great inspiration for medicine and for hospitals around the world in Christian thinking ever since. So that's fine. But then I think we come to the whole question of enhancement and exactly how far are we going to go with that. And I think, you know, in terms of the whole of humanity, you know, what we feel like as humans is that our relationships are really important, that being able to help one another is really important, that we have free will, moral responsibility in ways that give us value, because then what we decide makes a real difference, and so on. So it's this relational aspect that I think is very much missing from the transhumanist dream.
Yeah, well, you've pointed out in a recent paper that a lot of transhumanist voices are male, and they prioritise autonomy rather than mutual caring.
Well, that's right. I think if you look at the high priesthood of transhumanism, it is a very male high priesthood. Not entirely so, obviously, but many of the leading voices who write books and enthuse about transhumanist ideas tend to be male, I think. And I think often, you know, when we create things as humans, we tend to create things in our own image. And if we're males, we tend to create things in a rather male-orientated image. And that isn't necessarily valid for the whole of humanity. And I often think, actually, when the transhumanists are talking in most sort of futuristic terms, that I very much feel like I'm in Silicon Valley, I'm dreaming dreams, and I'm really not very much in touch with the rest of humanity.
Molecular biologist Dennis Alexander of Cambridge University. The full discussion next week, and you can find details of his Australian tour on our website. China has the unique distinction of being the world's most atheist country and having the world's fastest growing Christian population. It's also home to a rising Muslim population. So how is the Chinese government handling these ascendant religions? Are they competitors for power? Yanan Wang, Beijing correspondent for the Associated Press, has been investigating.
Yeah, my colleagues and I traveled to Henan, which is a central province in China. It's one of the most populous provinces. It's also believed to have the greatest number of Christians in China. What we saw on the ground was that basically a lot of what is called house churches in China, which are more informal churches, sometimes just in people's living rooms where they will congregate, a lot of those have been shut down since the start of February when the new national religious regulations were put in place. And these are institutions that have in the past largely been tolerated. They can range in size from just dozens of congregants to hundreds. But in the past, authorities sort of just turned a blind eye to these places and allowed them to congregate. But since this February, we've seen that they've been shut down in spades.
Tell us, what are these national religious regulations?
These are regulations that have been in place in the past. So they just updated them this February. For instance, one of the regulations says that churches should submit to surveillance. And one of the ways that that has been enacted is that churches are being asked to install surveillance cameras within their premises. And I interviewed one house church in Beijing where they refused to do this. And since then, hundreds of their members have been threatened and intimidated and told to leave the church.
Part of the national religious regulations appear to be an effort to, and you've written this, Sinicize religion in China. That is, make it more Chinese. What do they really want to do there? What do they perceive as the threat?
The Sinicizing of the five major religions in China has been a call from the Chinese government for a few years, but just recently they've really intensified this push. What it means basically is that every religion in China should be imbued with Chinese characteristics and should be indigenous to China so that it's not led by, for instance, foreign missionaries or other foreign organizations coming to China to tell Chinese people how they should worship, but rather it should be built up from the ground. However, another level of this is the idea that even though Chinese people are free to practice their faith by law, their faith should be secondary to their loyalty to the Communist Party.
And the local Chinese propaganda, at least the English language version that we get in the West, argues, I think you've reported, that no religion should be allowed to be seen as superior to Chinese culture or law. So how are they enacting that?
So, for example, in Henan, what we've seen is that they've been asked to take down religious signs and banners. So something that is very traditional in China is that around the Lunar New Year festival, people will put up these banners side by side around their entrance. And people who are religious, specifically people who are Christian, will put up banners that have crosses, or they will mention God or Bible verses and things like that. And authorities in Henan have basically gone door to door asking people to take these down. And in some cases, they've even been asked to replace these posters with posters of, for example, traditional Chinese painting or political posters. Not in Henan, but in Anhui, we interviewed an official who actually acknowledged what he said was that these people voluntarily removed, for example, a poster of Jesus Christ and then put up a poster of President Xi Jinping.
It's not just Christian communities that have been targeted in this crackdown. What has been happening with the Chinese Muslim population? We've read a lot in the past about the Uyghurs, but beyond the Uyghur community, there's other Chinese Muslim populations that are suffering this crackdown. What's going on there?
We know that the Hui Muslim community, their faith has been tolerated pretty much quite freely. They've been able to practice and they have quite a large presence in certain places in China, such as Ningxia. But recently, the government has enacted certain things such as the demolition of domes. So they call these Islamic-style domes, which are taken down. The local governments are saying is that these mosques are just too large and they don't abide by zoning regulations or the rules for how large you can build a structure in this certain place, even though some of these have been here for years or authorities have in the past seemed to accept them. this, I believe, is also part of the whole sinicization, to make it look less foreign in exterior as well.
And as I understand it, the Hui Muslim population, it has been more tolerated because Hui people are seen to be more Chinese in both culture and appearance than the Uyghur. Mm-hmm. So if they're cracking down on the Hui Muslim population, what does that mean for the Uyghur population who are simply viewed as foreigners?
Exactly. Uyghur Muslims have been put into what the government calls re-education centers. They're sort of like internment camps where members of the Hui Muslim ethnic minority are placed in these really large centers. They're detained for an indeterminate amount of time. And we've had people tell us that they're asked to swear loyalty to the party and to renounce their faith. But at the same time, it's very difficult to get information about what exactly goes on inside these camps because many people are scared to speak out about it and it's difficult to access.
You've also written about the Chinese fear of foreign money going to religious communities. How has this particularly affected the Muslim community?
Well, recently there was a standoff between police, local authorities, and Hui Muslims in Weizhou, where they have a very large mosque, which was built a couple years ago. And what we have seen in previous government notices is that certain mosques in this area, the notice did not name this mosque in particular, which is called the Grand Mosque. They've said that they received a lot of foreign backing without government approval for receiving these sorts of donations. However, the local community says that they funded the mosque themselves.
And just finally, this is all happening against a background of the Chinese constitution, which officially is supposed to ensure religious freedom. What does the Chinese constitution say about religious pluralism?
Well, the Constitution says that everyone is free to practice their religion and that non-believers as well should not be discriminated against for not practicing a religion. However, in practice, a lot of people are told that they can't practice unless they are doing so in a registered institution. So in China, for the Protestant churches, we have what is called three self-patriotic movement churches. And these are government-affiliated churches. They're registered and they're approved by the government. And all Protestants are encouraged to attend these sorts of churches. Members of house churches believe that for their faith, it's not correct to attend a church that is governed in this way. And so they've set up these house churches, which they believe to be a more pure expression of their faith.
Yanan Wang of the Associated Press. Finally today, while small churches around the country are closing, on the outskirts of Brisbane, a Chinese pastor is defying the trend. He's planting a church for people of all backgrounds, but in a classic Australian way. Siobhan Hegarty met him.
For a majority of the week, the Sunnybank Bowls Club in Brisbane South is exactly what you'd expect. It's a mecca for local retirees, a place to play bowls or bingo and enjoy a beer with mates. But at 5pm on a Sunday, this suburban club becomes a completely different place. It's home to the weekly service of Providence, a multicultural church plant led by Presbyterian pastor Mikey Tai and his wife Heidi.
The choice of a lawn bowls club was very intentional. It's been there forever. It's very central. It's accessible to people. And my first time in a church was really intimidating. I found the building itself really creepy. There's all these, you know, random spiky things, statues of eagles and different things, and none of it made sense to me. One thing we really wanted to do when we started a church was to choose a building that was familiar and neutral. And yeah, when people walk through the doors, they can feel at home. And that's something that we hear from a lot of our visitors, that coming to a lawn bowls club, it's not intimidating at all. And they can invite their friends because the average guy or girl, they don't feel scared coming in.
And it's no accident they landed in Sunnybank. Neither grew up in the area. Mikey's from North Brisbane and Heidi Herald's from Sydney. but the millennial couple wanted their church plant to reach migrant communities. And Sunnybank is the spot for such an undertaking. Almost one third of residents have Chinese ancestry, and more than two thirds have parents that were both born overseas.
It's a melting pot of different cultures and ethnicities and languages. You can get away with speaking your own language in the restaurants and supermarkets there. That's where you go for Asian groceries and Asian restaurants. And I love that.
In the 3 years since its launch, Providence has grown a congregation of more than 60 members. Heidi says they represent around 10 nationalities, but young Asian Australians are the core demographic.
Because we're younger, we're also ethnic, so we're Chinese, it's just made the gospel relevant. It's made Jesus relevant to maybe a certain group of people who have always, I guess, assumed that Christianity is for older people or it's a Western religion. Yeah, a lot of migrants, they do consider Christianity to be a Western religion. And for them to follow Jesus, they actually have to abandon their culture. But when they come to Providence and they see all these different ethnicities gathered together because of their mutual faith in Jesus, they realize, wow, maybe the God of the Bible doesn't show favoritism.
This cultural clash is something Mikey relates to personally.
Growing up as an ABC in a predominantly white neighborhood, which was on the north side of Brisbane, it was really difficult. My closest friends were Anglo-Australians and they had Western values, but I would come home and I would have to take my shoes off. I'd use chopsticks to eat food. I had to speak Chinese to my parents. I'd go to school often and people would tease me because of the way I smelt, or they would tease me and they would pull their eyes back and in a slanted fashion and laugh and run off. And that was really hard because I didn't know where I belonged. I didn't know what my identity was.
Parental pressure to excel in his education and career led Mikey down a path of self-destruction.
My parents had it all mapped out for me. I was the only son amongst five daughters. And so it was really planned out in the sense that they wanted me to become a lawyer, to make lots of money, to be successful and continue the legacy of our family in a sense. And so my years in high school were really hard. I flunked a lot of subjects. I partied a lot. I smoked a lot. And I did that all just to ease the stress. I was a 15-year-old kid who had just so much stress and anxiety because of the expectations on my life.
It wasn't until Mikey's sister introduced him to Christianity that things began to change. In his late teens, Mikey did missionary work in his mother's homeland of Taiwan. He hoped to become a pastor. But Eastern values run deep in Chinese families. At the wish of his father, Mikey completed a 5-year law degree before following his own path, a Master's of Theology at Bible College.
So when I told him that I wanted to become a pastor and not a lawyer, he hit the fan. Like, he was not impressed and he was yelling at me. But it wasn't until a couple of years ago that my dad actually became a Christian. And that's amazing, in his 70s. And he's now one of my biggest supporters.
That's Pastor Mikey Tai ending that report from Siobhan Hegarty, also ending our China coverage. And there's a link to Siobhan's interview and article on our website. And you can also hear RN's Hong Jiang speaking with the Chinese Bishop Peter Lin about the tension between religious values and Confucian tradition. That's the Religion and Ethics Report for this week. We're at the ABC Listen app, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks to Mudita Dias, Bryce Halliday and Wayne Ewan. I'm Andrew West. Back next week.